Hi guys, welcome to Julie Hinton Green, Living in the Now. And I am really pumped to have the opportunity to do an interview with a remarkable athlete. He played for the Toronto Raptors in 95 and 96, then got traded to Houston, won a championship, and back to Raptors in 2000. He's now a very successful analyst for the UCLA Sports Network, and he works on the games of the UCLA Bruins basketball season all the time. Welcome, Tracy Murray.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. And although I usually love doing interviews in my office so I can be face-to-face with my guests, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to chat with you. So where are you right now?
Right now, I am in Oakland, California. I'm on a road trip where UCLA is playing against University of Cal. And then we won that game couple nights ago, and our next game is at Stanford, so we have that game tomorrow night.
Exciting. So you're always on the go.
Yeah, every other week I'm out of town. Every other week is a road trip. Every other week is a home stand, so that's the way college is, especially in the Pac-12.
All right. And I know that you've done a million interviews in your career and in your life, but I'm going to try to make this one a fun one, try to make it stand out. So let's jump right into some questions. So tell the listeners, what's it like now to be on the opposite side of the game? Because for years it was you running up and down the court, sweating, getting out the endorphins, really feeling the pressure of all the eyes watching you. So to be able to be on the opposite side, analyzing the players, what does that feel like?
Well, it feels like sometimes it makes me want to get back out there and play, knowing damn well I can't. You know, it's over with, and I'm too old to do it. But being around the game, you know, it makes you continue to love the game the way you did as a player. And I really enjoy being around it and still part of it.
And it's true. It's actually a blessing to be able to be a successful athlete and then have a career after involved in the sports that you like. Like, for example, Tony Romo getting to be a successful Dallas Cowboy for years, and now he's on the opposite end. How often does that happen that you get to play your sport and then move into something to do with the sport?
Well, I mean, if you're trying to stay around the sport, then you got to pretty much figure it out pretty quickly, either before you retire, so you can transition better. And I didn't get to do that, so it was a little bit of a strain for me. I had to figure it out. Went to broadcast school while coaching. So I was like on the fence on whether I should coach or whether I should broadcast. And I think both of them go hand in hand, because as a broadcaster, all you're doing is coaching on the mic. You're calling what you see. You're saying probably in some plays or what you would have done differently from a coach's point of view, or maybe a player's point of view, or, you know, you're actually in the fire coaching, you know. So I was on the fence with that. And I had my hand at coaching in the WNBA with the Tulsa Shock. I was in the G League with the Bakersfield Jam when it was the D League. And I was with the Lakers a couple years ago with Byron Scott. I was on his staff as the shooting coach. So I've had my experience as coach as well. So I still coach. I coach young, high school kids in AAU now with my brother's Prodigy program. So I'm still getting my coaching fix along with my broadcasting. And I think the broadcasting, when it comes to a job, I think it's a cooler seat than coaching. I mean, coaching is so much pressure. You see guys age really quickly because of the pressure of being on the sideline, and you judge by wins and losses.
Right.
But broadcasting is the seat's a lot cooler.
Yeah, just being in the industry of professional sports can be very, very stressful. And I know that there's a lot of athletes, whether it's the NBA or the NHL, when they come out and they're done their career, some of them really get depressed and feel down. Do you ever mentor any other athletes that are coming up to retirement just to kind of guide them in the direction that you went in?
Yes, of course, because I've been there and done that. I was depressed. And my dad had to pull me out of my bedroom and pull up the shades and tell me that I was too young just to lay there and do nothing and be depressed. Get up out there and try to figure your life out. And this is the same thing that I'm trying to do nowadays. You know, just try to give people options on what's out there, you know, because a lot of us have played the sport since we were kids. And then when it's finally all over, it's like a death. And,
right.
And people have to deal with that. You know, they have to deal with it a certain way. And some people need time. Some people, they plan accordingly and transition better. But those who don't and think the sport is going to last forever, we have a hard time with depression at the end because it just seemed like an abrupt stop. But it really wasn't. It was winding down, and we didn't accept it because we thought it was going to last forever.
Yeah, I could see how that could be a hard thing to accept if you're in the limelight, even when you're starting off in high school and college and then moving into the professional league. It's hard to believe that it's eventually going to end. So lucky that you had your dad to really help you stay grounded, stay focused, and carry on with a successful career. What do you think, Tracy, is the biggest difference between the players now that are just hitting the court compared to the ones that you started off with back in your day?
Well, the game has changed so much. It's players are going to play, and they're going to adjust to the way things are on the court, whether, you know, styles of play, you know, stuff like that. I think they're more athletic than we were. I mean, they run and jump like crazy. We ran, but, you know, we only had a special few that can fly like these kids and move like these kids at the size that they are. You have guys that are 6'10", 6'11", 7 feet that move like guys that are 6'6", 6'7". And that, you know, that's something that didn't happen too much back in our day.
Where do you think that's from? Is it the hormones and the food and the milk that we're drinking that are making these kids bigger? Or are they just training in a different manner that than you guys knew about back then?
They're training in a different manner than we knew back then. You know, a lot of us were just hoopers, and we worked on our basketball game. We didn't really train like they do now. These kids start training at an early age. They start training at, you know, 10, 11, 12, you know, just trying to do other things, the less glamorous things that we hated to do back in the day and that we didn't do until we got to pretty much college. These kids are doing it at an early age now. So now you see the explosion. Now you see the strong bodies at an early age. And you know, the bodies are maturing and they're ready for college basketball physically, or maybe the NBA a little bit earlier physically. You know, maybe not mentally, but physically they're more ready than we were.
Okay. So, yeah, physically their bodies are ready. But at the young age, they're so much pressure on their shoulders. And that's something that I wanted to ask you about, Tracy, because you were known to have a sharpshooter, lethal three-point shot. And the pressure that must be on your shoulders to kind of fill out that title, how did you deal with that pressure? Did you get nervous, or what did you do?
Well, I mean, especially in my sense, I mean, I when you come off the bench and you're a role player and you're a sixth man, so to speak, and you're not a starter, your mistakes are, you can't make mistakes. You have to come out there and you got to be sharp. It just seems like every coach I played for, I never really had the total freedom unless somebody was hurt. You know, if somebody was hurt, then I had a little bit more freedom. But I had, like, as somebody that's quote-unquote a sharpshooter, if I had two misses, then I may as well just start heading right towards the bench because coaches are less patient with guys that come off the bench and are not coming off the bench on fire or coming off the bench, you know, helping the team boosting where they were, you know, when you came in the game from when they came out. If you're not providing a spark, then they would get the starters back in a hurry. And, you know, I had to learn how to deal with the pressure of I had two misses. So I had to find out how to be comfortable within that.
which is a lot. That's a lot to do. I mean, in any sport, you're on the field, you're on the court, you're on the ice, and you're doing your job. And then when you leave, there's going to be people that are critiquing your every move, whether they're other professionals or just fans watching. And how do you kind of, do you zone out the critiques, or are you open to hearing them and thinking that they help you improve?
Well, it's a whole lot worse now, you know, because everybody's got an opinion. Social media is around and people express their opinions. A lot worse than it was. It is now a lot worse than it was when I played. You only had to listen to a couple of beat writers you never played before, you know, and you kind of take that with a grain of salt, you know. But when you have every Tom, Dick, and Harry saying you suck or you can't do this and you can't do that, and they've never picked up a basketball on this level, you know, some of these kids nowadays are not as mentally tough or strong, and they're fragile, and they listen and read this stuff. I feel bad for those guys. You know, I mean, we were mentally tougher back then, where we just let stuff roll off our backs and we weren't as sensitive. So, I mean, we only took it with a grain of salt. But these kids are so much more under the microscope than we were that I feel bad for them.
And mental health, you know, it's obviously a serious topic. They talk about it. I know for the training camps in the NHL, and I'm assuming in the NBA, they take time. They take a week or so to help new athletes and athletes adjust to mental health issues. I know that they do some testing just to find out where these kids are at, how they handle the pressure. When you were first starting out in your career, were you guys ever talked to by either the coaches or people on the sidelines about your mental health?
No, not at all, because back then, we're from the suck-it-up generation. Nobody's trying to hear that. You're in a grown man's sport. Nobody's trying to hear what your mental problems are. Leave that outside the locker room. You come in here ready to play. So there was nothing ever addressed to that. I mean, you were looked at as mentally weak in our day if you came in the locker room with something like that. So, you know, guys kind of harnessed it and hid it and never brought it around. Yeah, they were dealing with stuff, but you wouldn't know about it. But today's kid, as I say again, social media and under the microscope so much, you know, kind of the water kind of overflows for them, you know, out of the glass, and they explode. And now you're seeing more and more people being honest with the mental health situation. You've seen Kevin Love, you've seen DeMar DeRozan, you've even seen coaches like Tyronn Lue. I mean, it's a real thing out there, and it's not something that just happened. It's been happening for years. It's just that, you know, back then you were looked at as weak if you brought it out. So, you know, guys hid it pretty much.
And I think, yeah, you touched on an important topic, DeMar DeRozan. I know originally he reached out through Twitter and talked about him feeling lonely and depressed. And I think for a lot of people, it was so shocking. How can this NBA successful player say that he's lonely and depressed? But that is reality. And no matter how people see you and what light they see you in, what's going on the inside, in your gut, in your heart, can be very different.
Yeah. And people don't understand that we're on the road a lot in the NBA. Tons. Now, if you're married, you're without your wife. If you have kids, you're without your kids. If you're tight with your parents and your siblings, you don't have them. You know, you're traveling with 12 other dudes that aren't your family. You know, so your family's who you're closest to. You go to bed at night by yourself. You know, only home games you're with your family. And then road trips come. You don't want to leave them. You know, now imagine those that don't have a family with them. Now, like for example, our first time in Toronto, and I had a blast up there the inaugural year. I really enjoyed getting to know a lot of people in Toronto, the organization, the community, my teammates. You know, and I think we didn't have cell phones back then, so you really got to know people. You know, you had conversations. You know, you had fun with people. You know, nowadays, you got these phones, and they kind of block them. They've got headphones, and you kind of block yourself off from the world so you don't get to know people. So you're a lot more lonelier now than you were then.
And being up in Toronto the first time, this is the first time an NBA team has ever been out of the country of the United States. So you had Vancouver who had their team, and then you had us. So it's like we are 12 to 15 guys that are living out the country without our families. And you know, we banded together as a band of brothers. I mean, that's probably the tightest team I've ever been with. We all still keep in touch to this day. We went out, we did things together, we ate dinner together, we went out together, we worked hard together, we fought together, we, you know, everything we did was together. It was almost like a college situation, so it was really a unique situation. Unlike nowadays, it's normal now for the Raptors to be in Toronto, and it's just like any other organization now where, you know, people come in. Now, as I say again, you have the cell phones, the headphones. People don't get to know people anymore. People isolate themselves. So, yeah, it's more of a lonely life than it was back then.
Yeah, I could see that. And I think it's great that you guys all came together and really had that brothership. And, you know, that's the thing about social media. In a way, yes, people are more isolated because when you're sitting beside somebody, maybe on the bus, when you're driving to the airport, instead of engaging in conversation, you're checking out your social media. But then at the same time, people are also posting a lot about their lives and what they're up to. So I guess the fans and the listeners and the people that love them kind of get to see more about their life.
Yeah, probably a little too much, though. I mean, it's almost to the point to where they don't have privacy anymore. You know, it's, and I've always, you know, I'm very much a presence on social media. But, you know, you have to know what to post and how much to let people in. You still want some of your life to be private. You still, you know, want your time with the people you love not to be exposed all over cameras and social media and stuff, you know. And I still, you know, I don't put my family on social media for a reason, because I want that part of me to be, you know, sacred. I want that to be cherished. I don't want it invaded by a bunch of people that I don't know. And you know, let's just say it. There's a lot of weird stuff happening in the world today. I don't want my family to be victim of it.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. That makes sense. My husband's also a very super private guy, so I tend to post some stuff about the kids and my life, and he's the complete opposite. He would prefer if the kids were never on social media. And I also find with social media, you are always judged. So speaking, for example, I had recently posted a picture that I had done at a photo shoot. So for me, this is a picture that I did at a photo shoot. I wouldn't normally wear these clothes out day to day, and nor would I expect people to judge either my mind or my inner being on this one photo. But I got some negative backlash from, number one, my business coach, but also from some listeners and some people that said, wow, Julie, how could you post a picture of you in bra and underwear? What if people don't want to interview with you? Or what if people think less of you? And to me, it's like, wow, this was a photo shoot that I did for a magazine, and I'm comfortable with showing both sides of me. But then why did I post that picture? Do I need the negative stuff coming up? So, yeah, it could be a lot.
Right, but don't Victoria's Secret post photos in magazines and on their online sites to push their product? I mean, what you did is no different than what models do, and that's part of what you do. It's part of your brand. So I don't see why the negative pushback from it. But you know what? That's what people do online. There's a lot of cyberbullies, and if you're not strong enough to take it, then, you know, you're going to kind of go over the edge, and then that's where the mental health thing comes in. You know, I'm real simple with mine. You know, you post something negative or have negative comments on my page, I'll block you and delete you in a minute. I don't care. I don't care if I lose a fan or not. The bottom line is I want positivity on my page. You know, I don't get into negative stuff. So, you know, I just try to keep it. And that's probably why I don't have a lot of followers. There's a lot of people I deleted.
I think that's better for sure. And I mean, you have a ton of followers on Twitter. And I know we were talking about how in Twitter you have the official, whatever that blue checkmark is. And you just recently jumped on Instagram. And I mean, numbers are just numbers, and some people really look at their numbers. I mean, not you, because you are already a true athlete, successful, had an amazing career. You are Tracy Murray. But I think other people define their career and define their success just by numbers, which again is a scary road to travel.
Shoot, you'll be surprised. You know, there's a lot of professional athletes that, you know, look at their numbers and I got this many followers. I mean, at the end of the day, the number of followers don't matter. I think the quality of followers is what matters. You know, if you can, you know, maybe get some contacts or some people that followed you that can possibly help you better yourself, and maybe you can better them, I think that means more than a bunch of meaningless followers that you know, could be some negativity or just existing as a follower. You know, I like to engage with my followers. I like to, you know, maybe get into a discussion about the NBA or maybe life or something like that. But if there's any negativity, you can have a discussion without it being negative. But
right.
it's like, you know, once they start shooting crazy stuff at you, then it's like, all right, I'm done. You know, and if it gets any crazier, then okay, delete or block. Because it's honestly, I don't have the energy for negativity. And you know, especially, you know, as you get older, you get less tolerant with BS. You know, you just don't do it, you know, and so that's where I'm at now.
Yeah, I think as you get older, you do become more confident, more grounded in your own skin, and you can really know, pick and choose what makes you feel comfortable with. I was actually on your Instagram page as I was preparing to do this interview, and I noticed you did post a picture, though, with your son, right?
Well, he posted it first.
Okay.
We went to the Warrior game the other day.
Yeah.
So he posted it first. So, you know, one thing I want with my son, because he's 14 years old, and he's one of those guys that don't play sports. So if you don't play sports, that means you're not part of the popular crowd. You know, and he's got red hair. He's tall. So he's different. You know, and when you're different, people tend to poke at you, especially if you're not part of the popular crowd. So I don't mind helping him get more followers or people knowing that that's my son, follow him. He's trying to do things on his own. He's a YouTuber. He's, you know, he wants to be an actor. You know, he wants to try his hands in modeling because he has a unique look. And he's a handsome kid. So it's
let me just tell the listeners, when I saw him, I said, wow, this is a handsome kid. He is so tall, and I didn't think that he was 14. Is he almost as tall as you?
He's 6'4", and 14
wow.
years old. So, I mean, he's really tall. He's handsome. He's really a good kid. And you know, you don't want people like that to be bullied. You know, he's not the type of kid that's going to go out and fight people. He's just really a good kid. So it's like, you don't want him, you know, people are cool online. They'll bully you, you know, if they think you're a nerd or something like that. I mean, for people that are listening, hey, I'm a nerd. You know, I do computer stuff. I'm very creative with stuff like that. You know, and some people think that being a nerd is bad. No, it's being smart. It's being creative. It's entertaining yourself without, you know, doing something that's going to harm you. You know, you rather try to grow, you know, intellectually or like that. And he's trying to grow in that manner. He's not doing anything on the court or in the sports world. So he's trying to find his way. He's trying to find his confidence. And anything that I can do to make him feel like he's the man at school, I'm going to do that because I want him to be confident in who he is and what he is. And so if posting a picture with me on the court at the Golden State Warrior game at halftime with him is going to help him feel like he's the man, if the picture that he took with Steph Curry on his Instagram and Kevin Durant and The Rock and Sheamus,
nice.
And all of, you know, if he can take pictures with these guys and feel like the man at school and everybody's like, man, how did you take, and he gains friends by that, and people want to get to know him and really find out about him, then I'm all for it. You know, I want him to be, I want his high school experience to be better than mine. You know, and mine, my high school experience was really different. You know, I went from being with my friends growing up in Pasadena to moving to Glendora and having to start all over again with trying to make friends. And I'm in a situation where basketball is going to automatically bring me, you know, people that's going to be around. But my real friends was back in Pasadena. And now I'm in a whole situation where I'm a, you know, in America you deal with this. I'm a black kid in an all-white town, and it's like I'm looked at as a science project. So it was really difficult for me through high school. I don't want it to be difficult for him through high school.
I totally understand where you're going with this, not about being like a black kid growing up myself, but wanting to give confidence to your kids, because we all had different experiences that we went through high school and even elementary school. And I personally joined my kids' parent council. I never would have thought that I'm going to be on the parent council for my kids' school, go to meetings. But I know that when my kids see me in the school volunteering, it gives them a sense of confidence. So it's amazing that you can take what you had to go through at that time of your life and realize that you're going to give your son all your love and all your attention to make him have the best life possible. That is amazing, Tracy. So what did you do?
And then when you have girls, it's even more different, you know, because as girls grow up, you know, they start getting interested in opposite sex, and guys can be cruel, you know. So I'm glad I'm not at that stage with raising my girls yet. I'm, you know, they're 6 and 4, but I very much have them in athletics. And you know, my 6-year-old is very athletic. My 4-year-old wants to do everything the 6-year-old does. So the girls are going to grow up different than my son, because my son was before my marriage with a different woman. So his situation is going to be totally different. I mean, his sisters love him to death, wish he was around more. But you know, now, you know, when they're in the same household as you, you have a little bit more control and more hands-on that I do with the girls than I did with him. You know, his situation, you know, you're splitting time and stuff like that is not the same. So whenever you go out of your way in a situation like that, you know, to make sure he's good, because he's not under your care the whole time.
And I know you touched a little bit already on the fact of when you were on the road traveling, it was so hard to be away from the kids and the family unit. So you're still in that scenario now, right? When you travel once a week, so you leave the two daughters and your son, and you're on the road alone.
Yes, and that's difficult. You know, it is. You know, I was with my son earlier this week. You know, I'm still in the same town. I'm going to pick him up tonight. We're going to go get a bite to eat and go to the movies and hang out and spend the night and that type of deal. Last night, my wife was here for Valentine's Day. And it wasn't just for Valentine's Day. She had a basketball game on the road that she was refereeing, and we just happened to be in the same town for Valentine's Day. So I went to the game to support her. And then, you know, we spent dinner and Valentine's Day the rest of the day with each other. I miss my girls terribly. You know, the girls are with the grandparents. But I miss them, you know, and you know, you have to do the best you can with the technology we have nowadays, and, you know, do FaceTime and stuff like that, so you don't feel as bad as you did in the past when you just didn't see them, you just hear their voice.
Yes, we're lucky about that. Through FaceTime, we can stay connected, and of course, if your daughters can physically see you on the phone and hear you talking to them and spreading love with them, that's amazing. Another thing that I wanted to share with you and the listeners is we are at a very lucky time in our life that we have technology to help us bridge certain gaps. So in Toronto last night and in the surrounding areas of Toronto, there was an Amber Alert that went out. I think it originally came across the phones at 12 p.m. and then again at 2 a.m. and then again at 5 a.m. And, you know, this was an Amber Alert notifying people that there was an 11-year-old girl who had been kidnapped, and her birthday was on Valentine's Day, which was yesterday. And people have took to the airwaves today, and they are complaining about how this Amber Alert bothered them, how they were trying to sleep and they felt annoyed about it. And as we woke up this morning, we found out that that little girl was killed by her father. And it's devastating. I try to use my platform to only share positive energy and love and light. But this is an issue that I can't believe that people are so caught up in their own lives that they're complaining about being bothered by an Amber Alert. And the little girl got killed last night.
You know what? And that's a sad case. And I'm sorry for, you know, the little girl. Just really sad. But this is a situation where, you know, this is what's going on today. People are so much into their own lives, they don't care about the next person anymore. When I grew up, you know, love thy neighbor.
Right.
You know, you walk up and down the street. If you're cutting up and messing up and you're doing bad things up and down the street, the neighbor used to whoop you. You know, used to spank you. And then when you get home, you got spanking from your parents because the neighbor called your parents and said, hey, I caught him doing this over here. I spanked him. You know, the village raised you. And everybody was better for it. And I think nowadays there's no discipline in the world with the kids. And the inmates are running the asylum, and it's not good right now.
Yeah, there's definitely a different type of community. Like you said, the community is used
entitled.
Yeah, people are entitled. There was definitely a different sense of community where everybody looked after each other. And now it is a very different world out there. What's one of your biggest fears about, like, our kids growing up in this generation? Like, is there a fear that you think of, how are my kids going to be able to deal with something?
I'm really afraid of my daughters being teenagers. I really am. With human trafficking, with the young men not being young men, you know, they're being boys.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot I'm really afraid of. And, you know, they always say men mature, you know, slower than women. But I'm really afraid that my girls are going to grow up. And I had this discussion with my wife last night. I'm afraid that my girls are going to grow up and not have a man in their life. You know, they're going to have a little boy that's trying to play the role of a man that doesn't know how to be a man. And that's what I'm afraid of, because if he doesn't know how to lead the house, or if he doesn't know how to treat a woman, if he's not a gentleman and open the door, you know, the car door for you know, my daughter, or the door to walk in a building or the house or whatever, if he doesn't pull her chair out and to sit down at a table, or if they're walking up the street, if he's not by the street and she's not walking towards closer to the building, you know, these are gentleman things that you're taught when you're young by your dad, you know, mm-hmm. what I'm saying, how to be a gentleman. And these kids aren't taught that, and they don't know how to be gentlemen, and they don't know how to communicate anymore. Not just with each other in general, but the opposite sex, they don't know how to communicate with in a respectful manner. And I'm just going to go out and say it. You know, even though I was young and I was kind of out there a little bit, it didn't mean that I disrespected the other sex. You know what I'm saying? I was always friends. I was always cordial. You know, I was never a jerk, and you still have to be respectful and nice and cool to people. And I just don't see that with, and trust me, I'm around a lot of youngsters all the time. I broadcast UCLA around the college kids. We have an AAU program. We're around young men and young women that we train in basketball. And we have to mentor these kids because they don't know. They're not getting it from home like they used to. So I think that's another thing that's just so refreshing about getting to know these kids and having the opportunity to mentor them how to be good young men. And I think that's what I'm more afraid of with my girls.
And
on the flip side, with my son, I don't want to leave him out.
Okay.
the girls are glorifying the Kardashians. They're glorifying, girls on social media with their clothes halfway off, and they're glorifying strippers, and they're glorifying all kinds of adult stuff, and these are kids. What are they supposed to know about that right now?
Yeah.
I'm not saying eventually you're not going to know about it, because you will. But they're glorifying things that they're not really good role models at this point. And I'm not trying to sound like too old or anything. I'm with the times, but I wouldn't want my daughter to go the Kardashian route. I've been around that family when they were young and they were in the clubs all the time and stuff like that. I know some of the things, that they used to do when they hung out. I don't want my daughters being like that.
Tracy, I think everything you're saying is making sense. You touched on a few great points. Number one, communication is key. I think for us to be able to communicate with our kids and really share the right messaging is important. For you to be able to communicate with the youngsters that you're mentoring, how lucky are they to have Tracy Murray to look up to? Because leading by example is almost the most important thing. If kids see you doing
right,
something, setting the way, then they are going to want to be like you. So great that you can do that. Go on.
At the same time, you got to respect everybody. You know what I'm saying? You may not want your daughters to be like that, or you may not want your son to date anybody like that, but you can't knock people's hustle. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if this is the way they know how to make money,
right,
you can't knock it, because that's what they're educated at doing. That's what they're smart. That's the way they know. That's the way they grew up. They grew up hustling and they grew up grinding. And you can't get like mad at them if that's their way of earning. You still have to respect their hustle. I just
right,
don't want my kids involved with that. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I understand that for sure. They're successful. Everybody has their own niche thing that takes them to a different level. Last week in my show, I was doing a show on men's health, and I was also touching on, men's health and are men aware of certain things. And I was sharing with the listeners that I also have young kids. I know you said your daughters are 4 and 6. So I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. And the thing that I'm always focusing on and always thinking about is, STDs. In our generation right now, they're so common and they're going around. But fast forward 20 years when our daughters and our sons are going to be in that wave of life, everybody is going to have everything. And are people going to be mature enough to communicate and, let people know, wait a minute, I am, having this. So that's one of my concerns as a mother. How are these young kids going to be mature enough to deal with all these things? Does that ever cross your mind?
I don't think they are. You know what I mean? It's like they're communicating less and less now. You think something that embarrassing, they're going to tell the other person that they did it? It's like our generation, we communicated. We had to tell. If you care about somebody, you tell them.
I
don't think people care about each other like that anymore to let people know that, hey, this is what's happening with me, you might have it, or, I contracted something, you might want to check yourself out because I was with you last and I was clean before that. I don't think people want to have those tough conversations, it's like, especially kids, these kids, they communicate less and they really don't like confrontation. So it's really different nowadays.
I know. It's a lot. It's a lot to think about as a parent. So let's leave that topic. It's a lot. Let's leave that topic. And I want to ask you this, because I'm just getting into doing interviews and like having the opportunity to talk to people. And you've been interviewed so many times. What is it like when you are in the middle of a game and you're playing and you're sweating and you're focused on the game, and then all of a sudden it's halftime and somebody pulls you to the side and they're interviewing you? How do you mentally prepare to give an interview that is knowledgeable and on point, and knowing in the back of your head that people are going to be critiquing everything that you say?
thank goodness I didn't have to go through that part. That was the era right after, it was right towards the end of when I was on the way out and LeBron James was on the way in. You know, I wasn't one of those guys that was on fire by halftime that they had to pull to the side to have an interview going into the locker room. I was never in that position. So thank goodness I never had to do that. But to answer the question, you know, it's part of the job. And answering questions is not very hard, especially when you know the game and you just got done going through it. You can replay what's happened out there because it's still fresh on your mind. So I think, you know, you should be able to pull that off heading to the locker room because you just it's fresh in your mind. You just went through it.
Okay. And then what about other interviews? Because I'm in a scenario now where as I do an interview, like my heart is racing, I'm super excited, even having the opportunity to talk to you right now, very exciting. You say things and you're flowing and you're asking questions, answering questions. And then when you listen to playback, there's always a few things that you might want to tweak and change. And have you ever been in that scenario where you've given an interview, whether it's like after the game or even nothing to do with the game, and then listen to it in playback and realize, wow, maybe I shouldn't have said that?
Of course, because you always want to get better at your craft. So you're going to always go back, listen, tweak, rewind, critique everything that you say and do. That's the only way to get better. And, of course, you know, sometimes out of the heat of the moment when you like, for example, I played at UCLA. I wore those four letters on my chest. So this season has been really challenging for me because they're not having a good season at all. And to be able to try to stay positive and to say something, you know, that gives the fans hope that possibly it can turn around, it's hard to do. And sometimes I'm just live and direct with what I see because you have to call what you see. You can't be so home team to where you don't call what you see out there because you lose credibility now if you don't be honest with what you see out there. And within that honesty, you have to do it to the point to where you don't destroy the kid because they're still not getting paid to play the game. These are still kids. These are still young men trying to figure it out. So that's what you stuck in between. You stuck in between keeping it real and not destroying the kid, you know, because they have families, they're not getting paid. But then at the same time, this is the pressure going to UCLA. Mm-hmm. So that's what you stuck in between when you're doing broadcasting for the school. The passion, you know, there's a lot of passion involved.
There's a lot of passion for sure, and there's a lot of heartache, there's a lot of positive things, there's a lot of great big moments. I know something that you were faced with after you finished your career is you had a hip replacement.
Yes.
So how do you feel?
I had a hip replacement at 42.
42, wow. I mean, obviously the wear and tear as a professional athlete running up and down the court, it makes sense. How do you feel now?
I feel fantastic. I mean, when I had my first hip surgery at 14 years old, and I grew from 5'10 to 6'4 in 3 months, and it just got out of whack. And they had to go in, they had to cut the bad part of the bone out. The bone had to mend back together with 8 screws in place. And so my body was a little off balance from that point forward. But that leg was a little bit shorter than the other. The other leg, the good leg, became my dominant leg. It became my explosive leg, and that's where I was dunking the basketball for that leg. And that one took so much wear and tear that in my last year in Toronto, I went on the injured list and I had an arthroscopic hip surgery and I called my season, you know, I was done that season. And I watched through the playoffs and stuff like that. I didn't play. I got to the point where I was losing power in my leg. The bone chips would hit nerves, and the bone spur would hit nerves, and I would lose power in my leg. So they had to go in and clean it out. And Toronto kind of lost faith in me, the organization. they thought that I would not come back, you know, because it was the first of its kind. You know, no one ever had their hips split at that time. There was only two others that was going through the same thing, and there was one more shortly after me, and that was A-Rod and Theo Ratliff. They were going through that, but with the same doctor, and then I was the third guy, and then after that, it was Sam Cassell. And I don't think, you know, and I can't speak for A-Rod because, A-Rod, you know, baseball is totally different than basketball, but I know I wasn't ever the same explosive-wise when it came to playing basketball. It just seemed like my career took a nosedive after that. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, father time, injuries, all kinds of things play a part. And that was the beginning of the end for me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the beginning of the end in that form of playing, but to see where you still are and how powerful and impressive your career is still going is amazing. Very amazing. Yeah, really proud of you. So the other thing that I know you and I, we had had phone conversation, just getting to know each other a little bit leading up to this interview, and we were talking about when you played your career, and this is something that you shared with me that I found very impressive. When you played your career, the athletes that you played with, your teammates always tried to get you to like drink alcohol or maybe smoke, and you always took the stance that that wasn't for you during your career.
Right.
That's really impressive. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, of course it's difficult because you want to be in the circle with your teammates, you know, and then if you're not having a drink with them, then you're looked at a little bit different. You looked at maybe as a snitch or maybe a tattletale of what the team is doing. You know, I didn't care. I didn't care less what the guys did. You know what I mean? I was out with them. So if I wasn't having a drink being out with them, now, you know, now I'm going to tell on you because I'm not doing what you're doing. I just found that really weird, you know, and it bothered me a lot. And I think the first time I took a drink, I was playing in my last year in Europe in 2007. I was playing in France. No, actually, I was playing in Greece. It was the year before my last year. And I went out with a teammate, and he was from Los Angeles, so he was like a little brother of mine. And I was, you know, far away from home and, you know, going, you know, when you drink for a reason. You're not just drinking the drink. And yeah, I was missing home. I was a little homesick. I was a little depressed that I wasn't with my family. But I was happy that I was with him. So it was a matter of being happy going out with him and his wife. And then on the flip side, it was a little bit depressed of not being around my family. So, yeah, you know, I had a couple of drinks that night. That was the first time I took a drink. And that was at 34 years old. The first time I took a puff was 37. That was 36. That was my last year in France. Same situation, you know, going through it with the coach over there. We were in first place. He absolutely killed us in practice one day that we lost a game. We had a 10-hour bus ride up, 10-hour bus ride back. Absolutely killed us. I was older. My body couldn't take it. And, you know, and guys got together in the garage. And I was like, here, pass it over here. You know, that was my first time taking a puff. You know, and, you know, did I feel any different or I was just, okay, let me try it out. It's no big deal. Let me see what it's about. You know, never done anything past that. But in the NBA, when I was at the pinnacle of my career, I always had this one thing in mind. Number one, you're a role model. And at the time, people were kind of looking down at on weed. Or marijuana, and then alcohol. You know, there was mothers against drunk driving and all of these things, and people were getting DUIs, and people were looking down on that situation. So, you know, as a role model, you try to be as clean as you can. And number one, Number two, I wanted to stay clean for the fans, and the reason being is they paid a lot of good money to see us play. They don't need to see me out there off of a hangover trying to play or under the influence out there trying to play. They didn't need to see that out of me. I just wanted to make sure they got their money's worth out of me. So that's another reason why I didn't do it.
Very honorable, Tracy. That's very honorable words. And, you know, I'm living in Toronto, and marijuana is pretty much legal over here. And I was sharing this with you, and I'll just share it with the listeners. I do my podcast out of my office, where I also do Reiki sessions. It's at 1235 in Yorkville. And I had left my office, and I noticed the office beside me was open, and I, like a nosy neighbor, stuck my head in, and I realized, wow, this office is fully set up to do proper podcasts. They had the foam on the walls to absorb the sound. They had an amazing desk set up, better microphones than me, better everything than me, and I was a little bit envious, and I stuck my head in, and I was asking the guys, like, what they're doing, what their podcast is on, and they said their podcast was on cannabis. And I said, here's my business card. I would love to be a guest. And they gave me a vape, which was like a CBD vape that is just a body buzz. So when the kids go to bed, I have to admit, the kids go to bed and I come into, you know, outside on the balcony and I hit my vape and I feel very relaxed. I feel more spiritual. I feel more grounded. I feel just a really, really great feeling. And there is so many different variations of marijuana and they do so many different things to the body.
Right. I mean, you're starting to see scientifically where it's healing the body and in different situations. I take CBD drops, and it's no THC in them. Now, people need to understand THC is the stuff that make you high.
Right.
You know, CBD is just by itself. It doesn't. And I'm using hemp plant, not marijuana plant. So it's completely different. And ever since I've been taking the CBD oil on with the hemp plant, my body's been feeling great. I get up in the morning. I used to get up in the morning and go use the bathroom, and I used to feel like I'm going to break, like I was a piece of glass and I was going to break with every step. Now I can get out of bed and walk to the bathroom like nothing's wrong with me. Walk up and down the stairs like nothing is wrong with me. And I definitely noticed a difference since I've been taking. I've been taking it for about 3 months now.
Well, that's really positive. And on the other hand, that is so much safer for the human body than people who are taking painkillers and muscle relaxers.
Right. Yeah,
and
there's a
opiate.
Lot of pill poppers out there. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I mean, that damages your body. It damages your liver. It does more internal stuff to you than, you know, these CBD drops or the CBD vapes or whatever that's out there that also heals the body naturally.
Yeah, natural is definitely the way to go. And I think it's good that we share that with the listeners, because I work at a drug rehabilitation center. I've been there for 3 years now, and I go in once a week and I do a yoga, Reiki, talk about energy and healing and natural healing of the body. And a lot of these people who are in these clinics start off with painkillers. They start off with prescription drugs. And when the prescriptions run out, they turn to stuff on the streets, and it's a slippery slope. So definitely, weed is a healthier option to heal the body, for sure.
Oh, no, most definitely it is. Weed or hemp plant. You know, it's like you can find different CBDs out there that can help you in whatever problem that you have. And, you know, you just got to be educated on what you're doing. You know, you got to ask questions. You got to do your research. You don't just go out there and just try a bunch of stuff, because everybody now, since marijuana has become legal in a lot of places, everybody's in the business now, but not everybody is on the level. You got to find out who's on the level, who's legit, you know, what their strands are doing to help the body. You can't just go out there and say, okay, I want this, I want that, I want this, and go take it and think it's doing something for your body. You have to find out what heals, what is for the body, what makes you high, what doesn't, you know, what can you take that where you can function during the day at work, you know, what what passed drug tests and what doesn't. You know, because some people get tested at work. So, you know, it's like, that's why you have to do your research so you don't get in any type of trouble with your job or any type of trouble with anything else.
Absolutely. Research is key. Even myself, after they gave me this complimentary vape and they gave me this lollipop that I'm not going to dare lift because it is all THC and that would be... We all have to know our boundaries. So I was grateful for the lollipop. I know that licking the lollipop is not for me, but I did the same thing. I typed in Simply Pink Canada and I Googled them and I read about them and, you know, making the mature decision. Do I feel comfortable with this? The other thing that I was going to share with the listeners is as I do interviews with people, if I'm in person with them, I always like to do a little photo shoot after. Because you and I are so far away, we don't have the opportunity to do a photo shoot together. But I am doing the podcast in my Raptors jersey. And I wish, and my pants, and I wish that I had a number 35 Raptors jersey and I could wear it for the photo shoot. But my son has... You know, he's a 7-year-old boy, but I can fit into his jersey. He's got number 10, DeMar DeRozan. So I'm going to do a photo shoot in the jersey, and I'm going to get my graphic guys to, like, superimpose you into the picture. So that will be a fun promo piece for us to use. And I can't believe how fast 60 minutes has gone by. You've been an absolute pleasure to talk to. Tracy, you've been great. If there's one thing that you could leave the listeners with, one piece of advice to, you know, help them either follow their dreams or just stick with what they're doing, what would you want to say, speaking directly to either youngsters or just any listeners that are listening?
Take advantage of your time because tomorrow's not promised. I've had a lot of close friends, family, you know, teammates, guys I played against, leave this earth at a young age. So tomorrow's not promised. Time is valuable. Time is more valuable than money, to be honest with you. Take advantage of your time. Make good use of your time. With your time, be unselfish with it. You know, use your time to brighten up not only your day, but somebody else's day. Use your time in a positive manner, because tomorrow's not promised.
Tracy Murray, those are amazing words. I couldn't agree with you more. You've been an absolute pleasure to interview. Thank you so much for making time and also for being so open and really sharing your thoughts. And, you know, sharing is always a form of helping other people better themselves and seeing truly what you've gone through. I also think about you sharing when you finished your career, you were a little bit depressed and your dad needed to come and pick you up. So listeners, if you're not in the place where you want to be, just know that you have the ability to change your path and change your days. And we all get a little bit depressed, but how can you pull yourself up and better yourself? So again, thank you so much. Yes, thank you again, and peace out for now, everyone.